One of the big themes of the podcast this year is exploring how we can find more ease and joy in our gardens this season. And when I realized that was a theme that was going to keep coming up, I knew I needed to do an episode on permaculture, which is a practice that makes your garden more resilient and more low maintenance and more eco-friendly by capturing rain, building healthier soil, supporting pollinators all at the same time. It's a gardening practice that gives back to the world and to you. So I invited permaculture designer. She's a permaculture expert. All sorts of homeowners go to her to add permaculture concepts to their landscapes. Her name is Brandy Hall. She owns Shades of Green Permaculture, and she really is the expert of helping homeowners rethink their landscapes from a permaculture lens for two decades. And she gives us a great crash course. As a new homeowner, she really had me thinking about the different ways that I could use her three pillars of regenerative gardening and how even a small suburban yard can become a thriving ecosystem. Let's dig in.
Welcome to the Growing Joy with Plants podcast, where we not only learn how to care for plants successfully, but how to simply and affordably use our plant babies to cultivate more joy in our lives by doing so. I'm Maria, former plant killer turned happy plant lady, author of Growing Joy, The Plant Lover's Guide to Cultivating Happiness, speaker, podcaster, and most importantly, your new best plant friend. On Growing Joy with Plants, you'll find conversations about houseplant care, gardening tutorials, and wellness through the lens of plants.
Plant care is self-care on Growing Joy.
Hello, plant friends. My name is Maria. I'm here to help you care for plants and grow joy by doing so. If you're new here, welcome. If you are a returning listener, welcome home. I'm so happy that you're here. I'm excited to bring you to today's episode, but I just wanted to ask, if you haven't already, please take 2 minutes right now in your podcast player to leave the podcast 5 stars and a review, and also send an episode that you've listened to recently to a friend who you think would love it. I would love for this podcast this spring and summer in the growing season to reach as many gardeners and plant parents as possible to ensure that you guys aren't just growing healthy and happy gardens, but you're doing it with joy and you're doing it with ease and you're exploring whimsy and you're having fun. So please shout the podcast from the rooftops if you like it. And without further ado, here's my conversation on permaculture with Brandy.
Brandy, welcome. I'm so excited to talk to you about a kind of hot topic these days in the gardening world.
Thank you so much for having me, Maria.
Permaculture. Feel like regenerative gardening, permaculture, like these words that were never spoken 5 years ago are now what everyone's talking about. I mean, my best friend who can't keep a plant alive, if someone paid her, called me and was like, we're rewilding our backyard. And like, we hired a rewilding expert. They're a permaculture expert, but you know, there's so many different names for it. So I think it's cool, but you've been doing this forever. So how did you become the plant lady that you are today?
Well, thanks. First, it's really cool to hear that people are rewilding experts out there. I know like a couple of years ago, there was an article in the New York Times, I believe, about rewilding. Mm-hmm. And it seems like it became the buzz.
Yes.
So I got into this work pretty circuitously. My company, Shades of Green Permaculture, is celebrating its 18th year this year.
Wow.
Which is kind of wild.
Talk about being early to market.
Yeah. Talk about feeling old. But yeah. So it was definitely a very different world when I started the company in terms of perma what? Huh? What do you do? Mm-hmm. Than it is now. But I started, I guess the seed of the company started long before I was an adult. My folks were, my mom and my stepdad ran an ornamental plant nursery in South Florida and a seed company. And my dad, my stepmom were in Western North Carolina, kind of total different ecosystems, worlds, bioregions, cultures, everything. But I grew up kind of going between two places. And my mom and my stepdad in the nursery industry, really early on, you know, they were spraying very minimally regulated herbicides and pesticides, using hot suits or protective suits in the hothouses and greenhouses of South Florida. And turns out that the suits were, rather than protecting their skin when they get wet from the inside, which is inevitable when you're sweating and it's 100 degrees and 100% humidity, that it would actually trap the chemicals against their skin. So they developed like rapid allergic reactions to, you know, pretty, I put it in quotations for listeners, but pretty innocuous herbicides and pesticides, to the point where my stepdad was in a wheelchair for a couple of years. His joints were so swollen, he couldn't walk. He was having two hour long nosebleeds.
And they had no idea this was coming from the pesticides at this point.
They had a sense of it because my stepdad had like a pretty, he was starting to get sick. And then he had an episode where he did some spraying and immediately like couldn't walk. And so for him, it was a, you know, an obvious connection. I would say it wasn't widely diagnosed at that point. You know, we have this way of approaching herbicides and pesticides and just chemicals in general in our society of, you know, innocent until proven guilty. But unfortunately, a lot of the side effects don't take effect until, you know, decades later for a lot of people. So, but yeah, fortunately, maybe his feedback was really quick, real time. And so my mom took over the company at that point because my stepdad wasn't able to walk, was dealing with all of these health issues. And at that point, my mom had had kind of increasingly severe allergic reactions. You know, like she would smell a neighboring farm had just sprayed a field and she would catch it on the wind and her tongue would swell up and she would take Benadryl and, you know, it was manageable. But then pretty quickly after she took over operations and, you know, was doing more of the spraying and using the same protocols, those reactions kind of accelerated really quickly to the point where one time, you know, she had gone to make a delivery at a neighbor's farm and pulled into their greenhouse, you know, where their office was. These are like massive, you know, 40-acre greenhouses, and got out of the truck and smelled, oh, they just sprayed. She got back in the truck. She turned on the AC and took Benadryl. And then on their way to the hospital, they picked me up from school before the reaction got really bad. And before we got to the hospital, she was convulsing so hard, she shook the door panels off of her car door and her hands were drawing up like she was having a stroke and she was choking on her tongue. And, you know,
oh my God,
this is all to say that made a really strong impression as a young person, obviously. And I think that really started the inquiry for me early on. You know, like there's got to be a different way because, you know, in kind of diametrically opposed experience to that is I'm going on wagon trains with my dad and eating fresh organic vegetables and drinking water right out of the mountain and swimming in fresh lakes, you know, versus like the canals at the farm that were like sludge ponds that you couldn't even like get near and smelled so bad, you know? So I think both of those things like cultivated a love of the natural world and the beauty of wilderness and nature, and then seeing so palpably how much we undermine that through our practices, you know, starting in the ag world, but then just our land management practices in general. So that kind of, that was the seed of Shades of Green. And then, you know, many years later.
So did you go to school for sustainable agriculture?
No, I went to school. My undergrad is in children's literature, actually. And my master's degree is in contemplative education, which I feel like influences more my work now than anything. Just the education component is such an important part of the work that we do. But I, you know, a lot of my experience is just real world. So I first learned about permaculture when I was traveling in college and ended up on a farm in Guatemala. I was like, wow, this is amazing. Look at how much food is growing and there's such an abundance. And then started working on a permaculture farm in Virginia years later, got a general contractor's license and was working in the building world as a stonemason and contractor and trying to learn just about the human built environment. And then here I am.
So you were circling it for a while. Did circling you have it, a garden yourself? Like, were you interested when you were circling this thing that you do now? Were you trying these principles for yourself first and then doing them at scale with your business? Or was it really more of an intentional pivot into business first and learn along the way?
It was a little bit of both. I would say I was a hobby farmer. You know, I worked at a farm in Virginia for a few years that we practiced rotational grazing and, that was really my first like academic exposure to permaculture. But there was something really just incredible about eating, you know, 90% of my diet was just things that we grew on the farm, you know, having gardening, a compost toilet system, living off grid, all of these things that sort of ignited a passion, I would say. But then really, it came through my professional work. I started working as a site and education director for a permaculture nonprofit in Asheville, North Carolina, and, you know, was tending to the site and teaching classes and doing other things, and then started taking professional work on the side as sort of a supplement to my income, taking clients, and then pretty quickly realized, oh, there's a market for this and I love doing it. So that was kind of how the company itself grew, but it definitely grew out of a passion, you know, a personal passion for gardening and being outside.
That's so cool. Let's talk about what this is. So permaculture, sometimes called regenerative gardening, like what are all the different words for it? Rewilding. Mm-hmm. What are
ecological landscaping?
Yes. What are all the mm-hmm. different words for it? And also, what is it? Like, what is the definition?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I was having a conversation recently, kind of on the same topic, and I talk about it in my book that was just published, The Complete Guide to Home Permaculture, where I use permaculture and regenerative landscaping interchangeably. You know, if you were on an agriculture scale, you'd be permaculture and regenerative agriculture. We also hear ecological landscaping a lot. And I think while they each have perhaps like a different focus point, I think the end goal and the end outcome is the same regardless of the words that you're using. So, you know, when you're talking about ecological landscaping or ecological gardening, a lot of times that's really focused on, you know, the biodiversity and native plants and pollinator and songbird habitat, right? When you're talking about regenerative farming, you're generally talking about food production systems. And permaculture, I think historically has really tilted more toward production, you know, the idea that we're growing a lot of our own food and medicine and, you know, participating in our landscapes in a way. And then regenerative gardening or regenerative landscaping, I really like to think of, you know, regenerative is really just about closing loops. It's about tying things back to the system. So rather than, you know, a linear resource that comes from here and goes to there, and then we constantly are replenishing it, we're looking at how we can start to close the loops in our landscapes. And I think that that's really, you know, they're used pretty interchangeably, but the ultimate goal of all of those is for us to become active participants in our stewardship of our landscapes in a way that they feed us and they feed the life around us.
So today's episode, I want to really focus on permaculture for lawns, like for our homes on a very small scale. So I like this regenerative landscape instead of agriculture, because most people, that's how we're approaching this. Does it have to be food tied to food if you're doing it on a small scale? Because I feel like a lot of people think that it's it has to be about growing your own food and that abundance, farming, homesteading. Can you have a permaculture lawn that grows no food?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that's one potential outcome of a landscape, right? That's one aspect of a plant community is, does it produce food? But the way I like to think about permaculture, and I break this down in the book because I think it's the most simple way I can really describe it and why it transcends just the goal of food production, is it's about what I call the three pillars of a regenerative landscape. Regardless of whether or not your goal is to grow food or to grow pollinator habitat or to grow, you know, medicinal herbs. I've got a client that is an herbalist that grows tons and tons of herbs for her home apothecary. So she's still practicing permaculture, even though she's not eating 90% of her food off of her land. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's actually, I'll come back to the three pillars of a regenerative landscape. But first, the UN proposes that we're going to have 68% of our population globally living in urban centers before 2050, which is a huge number, you know, billions and billions of people living in urban centers. And I think the kind of the premise that we're not doing permaculture unless we're growing all of our own food, when we're also talking about, you know, nearly 70% of people living in small plot urban or suburban kind of context, you know, those are not necessarily, I don't think they need to be at odds. And so the idea behind the three pillars of a regenerative landscaper. How can we work with in any size landscape, whether you're on 100 acres or 1/10 of an acre, you know, if you're working with water as a resource and you're slowing it down and you're sinking it into the soil, so you're hydrating soils, you're replenishing groundwater and aquifers through your water management practices, reducing irrigation, all of the outcomes of that. So that's the first pillar. The second is to build soil fertility through cycling nutrients on site. So this could be, you know, your soil management practices, whether it's your sheet mulching and your double digging or your cover cropping or all these terms that you hear in gardening, or you have a compost pile or you have a worm bin or how you manage your leaves. Those are all kind of tools, you know, and tactics that we have to create closed loop fertility in our landscapes and types of plants we plant.
So I bet you understand in this episode that as we learn, if you're building a permaculture garden, you're not just building and growing plants, you're growing soil. And healthy soil is everything when it comes to permaculture. It's what holds water. It feeds your plants naturally. It creates that ecosystem that we talk about. And that's why I love working with Espoma Organic. I like to use their land and sea compost in my garden. It's a great soil amendment. It has lobster crab, kelp, all sorts of rich, nutrient-dense organic matter that is going to set your plants up for success. Also, if you're planting things this summer, you should be planting them with their Biotone Starter Plus. It's an organic plant food that you sprinkle into the hole that you're planting into. So when you're doing your transplants or when you're putting a tree in or when you're putting a garden shrub in the hole that you're putting that plant in, you're going to put the Biotone Starter Plus, and it's going to help reduce transplant loss. It's going to help the plants establish faster. It's a fabulous product. Everybody raves about it. I even put it in my houseplants now as well when I repot. Really realize that you're not looking for a quick fix when it comes to your soil. You're looking to build soil that gets better every season after season. And that involves compost and good plant food. And Espoma Organic is where you should be turning to find it. So you can find your local Espoma dealer at espoma.com, or you can click the link in the show notes to go to my Amazon storefront where I've curated my favorite Espoma products that I use on my indoor and outdoor plants. Thanks, Espoma.
And then the third is build plant communities. So you want to fortify biodiversity through building a plant community instead of just a plant, you know, as an individual species for one outcome or one goal. And you can do those. They look very different, whether you're on 100 acres or 1/10 of an acre, but you can do them in any context. And when you're doing those three things together, when you're working with water as a resource, you're building soil fertility and you're planting plant communities that feed yourself, feed habitat, feed pollinators, you know, all of the things, then you're practicing permaculture, in my opinion.
Okay, I have two follow-up questions. So this, particularly as we're talking about how many people are going to be in urban environments, so this movement for green roofs, like planting roofs that capture rainwater and keep them out of the sewers, blah, 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 is that permaculture?
Yeah, I think it fits within it. Yeah, certainly.
And then I think, so when I read your book, it scared the shit out of me because I live in South Florida. I lived right where your parents had their farm.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my goodness, I had no idea. Obviously, your parents were spraying those herbicides a long time ago. And hopefully, you know, I also don't live in a greenhouse or, you know, live on a farm. But I think there's such an opportunity. It's interesting to think about feeding yourself, but also feeding the pollinators. So I just bought a home here. And it's in an HOA area, and every single house, it's also shady because it's a beautiful community that has these oak trees that really like crawl and kind of cover the streets, which is gorgeous. Every single house has the same plants. Like there is no diversity on the street. And, you know, I need to like take possession of the house first and like move in and, you know, do those things first. But it's definitely one of my goals. Maybe we can connect on a future episode on this to like bring some biodiversity to my sweet street where, you know, we have birds and pollinators and things too in South Florida, but they're all just getting this weird hedging. So that's where I feel like this opportunity for bringing this concept that's often practiced on a very large scale to our yards is so exciting and appealing because you can really make significant impact on a small scale, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, you really can. Like one of the things we love to speak to is that there's no garden too small to make a big impact. Yeah. And it's really about you doing it and then your neighbors being like, oh, what's that? Is that a fig? Can I help? Mm-hmm. It grows here? Wow. You know, they're conversation yes. pieces and those things spread and then that builds a tapestry of, you know, biodiversity over time. Like what you're describing is sort of a food desert for pollinators, you know?
Yes, exactly. And it's funny, in my rental, we have a home. In my rental, I put some raised beds in the front yard intentionally because I planted a little pollinator garden in my raised beds in my front yard intentionally because I want all my neighbors to see it because nobody else has any flowers in their front yards. It's so weird in South Florida how it's like so homogenous down here.
It really is.
And I've had so many beautiful conversations with my neighbors about the beds and the flowers. And I was growing milkweed and, you know, we were hatching monarchs and I was doing the whole, like, it was so fun. So I really do feel like I'm excited to really unpack this with you because if you think about, you know, 1,000 people doing this, think about all of the ripple effect of that. So I'd love to kind of break down the three principles you were talking about on a high level. What was interesting in reading your book too, besides being scared in the beginning, was so much of this concept is just returning to what already worked that we broke as, you know, construction and development happened. So this water cycle that used to be complete is now broken because of how societies have evolved. And we have to kind of unlearn and fix how we've broken it. So can you explain the water cycle and how it works naturally and then how permaculture helps repair those rifts?
Yeah, and this is such a wonderful topic and one that I love speaking about because it's so, you know, water follows just very basic principles and they're the same regardless of where you are. But how we treat water, you know, you were alluding to this, in development, right? So let's start with kind of what the convention is. The convention is that we build a house, you know, or a shopping center or whatever, and we pave it, you know, we create a ton of impervious surface, you know, even if it's just the house extending to the lot lines and there's very little land to actually absorb the water that falls. And then we take our downspouts and we run those to our driveways and then the driveways drain to the streets and then the streets drain to the stormwater system and the stormwater system drains to the creeks. And then what happens is the soil's not absorbing the water when we have heavy rains. Instead, the creeks are taking it on. And so they swell, right? And we get flash floods. We have those a ton. I'm in Atlanta. And pretty much every time we have a heavy rain, there's so much impervious surface that it just causes flash flooding.
So floods come from the fact that back in the day, the land would absorb the water. And now the more pavement, the more construction there is, the less square footage of land there is to absorb the water.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's also like it's the water's channelized and it's all funneled to one area, to a creek or a stream, and those all run together. Versus if you think about how water falls in a forest, right? The big heavy raindrops, they land on the leaves of trees. And if you're standing in a forest, when it's pouring rain outside, it's usually just a mist that you feel under the canopy of the trees. So that's a great kind of example of, you know, what we're doing is we take the water and then we concentrate it and then we cause a problem downstream. Versus allowing our landscapes to absorb the water when it falls. So we might not all live in a forest, but what we can do is, you know, there are a lot of techniques that you can do, but the principle, the water pillar of a regenerative landscape is to slow the water down and allow it to hydrate the soils and to send it where it's most useful in your yard before it ever goes to the stormwater system. And so a lot of municipalities in our area are starting to catch on. Like you either update the stormwater infrastructure, which is, you know, millions and millions of dollars and super disruptive, or you require new construction and any adjustments to a lot to manage a certain amount of their stormwater or their rain on their site before it ever enters the stormwater system. And then that ends up saving, you know, tons of money for taxpayers. And also it has the ability to then, you know, rehydrate the soils and irrigate. So that folds into the next pillar, which is like the soil pillar is really about building your soil's capacity to hold the water when it happens. So the way we work with water in permaculture you know, at Shades of Green, we tap downspouts, we route those to, rather than going to a driveway and then to the stormwater system, we kind of dance the water around the landscape where it's going to be the most useful and allow it to sink into the soil first. Mm. And then it might, in a heavy rain, overflow, and then we manage it again and we manage it again. But for instance, in Atlanta, we have 75% of our rainfall happens in a 1-inch rain or less. So we don't even really need to build our earthworks or our rain gardens that large to manage 75% of the water that would ever fall on a landscape, you know? And if we manage for 5-inch rain events, which is still, you know, we get a couple of those a year, then we've managed 95% of the water that has fallen on our landscape before it ever enters the the stormwater system, which is pretty remarkable. And then the, like, you know, no pun intended, but the downstream benefits of that are we're not losing trees in flash floods because the banks of the creeks are so eroded because we've channelized all of the water. We're not losing topsoil because we've channelized all of the water. We're carrying our nutrients with it. And we've reduced the need for irrigation. So the, you know, the soil becomes the sponge, the soil becomes the cistern and helps to kind of mediate the effects of drought and flood over time, as opposed to just sending it away and then pulling in more. You know, turn on the tap, you get water from the lake up the hill. You know, in Atlanta, it's Lake Lanier or a reservoir, or, you know, turn on the tap and then you run your irrigation. And then when it rains, you just send it downstream, you know? So it goes back to that, what I said in the beginning, starting to close the loops.
Yeah. So when closing the water loop, as we're talking to probably some newbies here, what are the biggest mistakes you see people make? Probably they probably call you to come in and fix them, or just people that you know, like, what are the biggest mistakes you see people making when it comes to this closing the loop of the water cycle?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think there are a lot of different directions it goes. When you're talking about drainage, one of the big mistakes that I see a lot is people want to manage the water when it's at the bottom of the watershed. And you have so much more volume when you're there. So if you, it, like, practically you're thinking about, like, okay, you're on a lot and you're at, you know, you're on a little bit of a slope. To send all of the water to the low spot and then have to manage the whole volume, you know, it's much larger than if you had done it incrementally starting higher up. So where you might be managing 1,000 gallons at the top, by the time it gets to the bottom, all of a sudden you have to figure out how to manage 40,000 gallons of water, you know, and the force that that brings.
What are different ways of managing the water up at the top?
Yeah. So you can do, you know, the highest point on our watershed most of the time is going to be the roof. So a really simple thing to do is to capture the water that's falling off of the roof and direct your downspouts into rain gardens higher on a slope, you know, and as long as where the water is going into the pipe is higher than where it's coming out of the pipe, you can even have the illusion of sending water uphill. And then you can kind of plumb those together to move the water around the landscape, similar to the way you would fill an ice cube tray under a stream of water. Like if you start at the top and then one overflows to the next and the next cell over. So you're essentially doing that with rain gardens where you take your downspouts, you send them to one, and then when that one fills, it goes into a pipe and goes to the next one down the hill a little bit, and that one fills and goes to the next one, and so on and so forth.
So it's not about the rain barrel, it's about the rain garden.
Yeah. I mean, the cheapest way that you're going to be able to hold the water on your land is in the soil.
Okay.
So I always, you know, I always recommend that from the perspective of you're sinking the water in, you're reducing your need for irrigation, and you, it has the long-term benefit of replenishing groundwater and aquifers ultimately. But, you know, rain systems, rain harvesting systems, whether it's small barrels or large tanks, the question with those really comes to, like, to what end? So a big mistake that I see a lot of times with rainwater harvesting is it's way undersized and it doesn't have an overflow. So you might have experienced this before, but if you put a 50-gallon, you know, rain barrel under your downspout, it fills usually within like seconds, right? And then a lot of times those don't even have an overflow that's appropriately sized. Like you want the pipe that's going out of the rain barrel to be the same size as the pipe that's coming into the rain barrel. So a lot of times they will have an overflow, but it's like a 1/4 inch, you know, which is essentially a bottleneck. So what happens is the water starts spewing out of the top of the rain barrel and then causes flooding in the basement is what we see a lot, you know, or at the foundation, or in the crawl space. And so, you know, a really simple fix is to just make sure that the overflow that you put on it actually goes somewhere and that it's big enough so that that doesn't happen. But then if you zoom out a little bit, when we're talking about rainwater harvesting systems, it's important to understand the end use of them and the volume of water that you're going to need. So, you know, if you're trying to irrigate your entire half acre lawn by rain, that's going to be a very different sized system than if you're, you know, harvesting rain to, you know, water your dogs and have a mud kitchen for your child. You know, it's like those are very kind of like two different ends, or even just like harvesting it to, you know, water your small container garden, vegetable garden. So one thing that's really shocking, I think, for people is to understand just how the volume of water that falls. So if you take 1,000 square feet, which is like a, you know, a small house in the US, in a 1-inch rain from that roof, it generates 622 gallons of water.
That's a lot of water.
It's a lot of water. And then you multiply that, you know, in Atlanta, we get 50 or 60 inches of rain a year. So your capacity to harvest water is actually massive. But then it comes down to like the cost benefit of, you know, if you put in a rainwater harvesting system, you want it to be, if you're intending to irrigate with it, you want it to be sized large enough that it's going to be able to irrigate for roughly 1 inch of rain, simulating 1 inch of rain over the square footage of the area that you're irrigating for the number of weeks that you expect to go without rains. Again, like here in Atlanta, we can have summers where we don't get any rain, and that's 12 weeks. So you can just imagine if you have to irrigate a half acre, that's 27,000 gallons of water on an acre. So 13,000 gallons of water to irrigate a half acre, 1 inch. So that's 1 week, right? And you multiply that by 10 or 12 or however long the drought is.
Even for a small plot of land, you literally do this. You've been doing this for 18 years. I could hire your company to come and build a permaculture, turn my, you know, little postage stamp of a home into a permaculture oasis. What are the things that you look at in a first consult? Say, you know, for the people who want to apply these ideas, don't really know where to start. Like, what does a consult look like? How can I consult with myself if I'm looking at my land?
That's a really, I think that's a really great and powerful question. And it gets to kind of the heart of permaculture, which I like to describe as a responsive design. So it's really just based in observation. So our consultations are, when we work with a client, the first is to understand what the goals are. So, you know, are you, your landscape's going to look really different if your goal is to grow a ton of food versus entertain, you know, maybe not, but they can go a few different directions, you know, or having a big open space so your kid can practice soccer. Or so it's really important to understand what the goals are, because that's going to inform how the design kind of takes shape. And I like to think that there's no landscape that can't do something. It's just it's a matter of your creativity with it. So that's the first piece. And then the second piece is the observation. So, you know, when we come out to a site, it starts by just looking at what's going on and reading the existing conditions, so that way we can craft something that's responding to the existing conditions rather than trying to force something that doesn't want to be there because it's not the right light or it's not the right water profile or it's not the right type of soil. So we want to root all of our design work in real-time observations. So we would look at, you know, the slope, the light patterns, like where is it shady? Where is it full sun? And we, you know, there are apps that you can use to get reads of like what it looks like in the summer solstice versus the winter solstice. So we map those things. We look at the soil profiles. The existing vegetation can tell you a lot about the soil. You know, whether it's, you know, if you're in a pine forest with a ton of like smilax understory, it's going to be really acidic, you know, typically acidic clay versus, you know, I imagine where you are in South Florida, sand. It's pretty sandy.
Beach. My backyard is a beach in my rental. It's wild.
Yeah.
It is
wild. Yeah. So knowing that was really important. And then how water moves through the site is also a really important piece. So looking at where your downspouts are, if you have any major areas of erosion, if you have pooling, you know, all of that's just becoming information to craft a responsive design. And then we work with those conditions. So I would say no site, you know, we get questions all the time like, oh, can I do permaculture because I have full shade? Or can I do permaculture because I have, you know, a steep slope? The answer is always yes. You can always work with water as a resource, and you can always build soil and you can always plant plants that are appropriate, you know, useful and native plant communities. So,
yeah. So what about selecting plants? Obviously, you're saying, you know, everybody's going to have different goals, whether it's growing their own food, whether it's doing more pollinator friendly stuff. Is there a strong emphasis on native plants in permaculture?
You know, yes and no. The way we approach native plants, well, first of all, I think of plant, when you're choosing plant communities, we're always trying to design for maximum redundancy and resilience. So I've identified 13 functions a plant plays in a landscape. I think I talk about it in the plant chapter of the book. But, you know, whether it's pollinator habitat or a beneficial insect nectary or an aromatic pest confuser or a nitrogen fixer or a privacy screen or food producing or beauty, or, you know, there's a number, 13 that I've identified, different functions a plant can play. And any plant that we introduce, we want it to fill at least three functions within a landscape. And then all of a sudden, your landscape is, you know, it's resilient. It's got a lot of redundancy. It's filling a lot of needs within, you know, even a limited plant profile. And then the question of native versus non-native, my answer to that is always, it depends. So if there's a great native choice for what it is that you're trying to do, you know, then that's the obvious yes. But then if there's something where there's not a native plant that fits that niche, and you know, you can introduce something that's non-native. And then the question is, there's a decision-making framework that I actually lay out in the book as well, which is kind of, what's the mind map of, okay, it's not native, but does it, is it aggressive? No, it's not aggressive. Okay, well then, is there a native alternative that would fit a similar niche? No, there's not. Okay, well then that's a plant you should plant. Is, oh, it's non-native, it's really aggressive. Okay, it's really aggressive. Do you have a management plan for it that outlives you? No? Okay, probably don't plant that, you know? And so, or that outlives your tenure on that as the steward of that land. So that's generally the framework. But I think there's a quickness to demonize non-native plants as not appropriate, you know, mm-hmm. to use. And I think that it's, I don't think it's as cut and dry as that. I think,
especially, you know, when you're growing food, because like, it's, tomatoes aren't native.
Tomatoes aren't native. Lettuce isn't native. Yeah, most of the fruit you eat is not native.
Right.
Most of the spices you use are not native. Yeah. So totally. I don't think that it's so cut and dry. Like, is it native or is it non-native? I think really the question is it going to be aggressive in a way that it's going to crowd out biodiversity?
Mm, that makes sense.
You know.
What about aesthetic? Because maybe we do live in places with HOAs, like my new house. How do you, from a design perspective, not that it's non-aesthetic, but aesthetic mm-hmm. is the priority of permaculture. So when you're doing it from a landscape perspective, in a home, in a front yard, in a backyard, how do you make it look nice?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And it's also something that's unfortunate that that is the reputation that permaculture has gotten. You know, when I moved to Atlanta, the people that were teaching about permaculture were teaching that you had, in order to do permaculture, you had to build everything out of pallets and tarps and eat roadkill, mm-hmm. you know? So it was a little bit of an uphill battle to be like, no, I don't think that's
right.
true. But, you know, I think it's not necessarily that, I think good regenerative design or ecological design doesn't exclude the aesthetic, because inherently as caretakers of land, we're going to be the most drawn to the places that we find beautiful and inspiring. And that's part of us cultivating ourselves in relationship to the land. So there are ways that we can do that, that are, you know, there are conventions in conventional landscaping that we're kind of attuned to. So having a certain percentage of evergreen, you know, versus deciduous when you're in non-tropical climates, you know, so that there's some interest during the dormant season, or organizing things in a way that takes into account their structure. So you're not going to put the really tall thing in front of the small thing against the house, right? It's going to be, you want to like lead the eye. So there's just general design principles, I think, that work really well, regardless of what, you know, it's not like you're only doing permaculture if everything's zigzag and chaos. You know, you can have clean lines and you can have orderly borders. So that's one of the principles of designing for more wild spaces, is if we have spaces, you know, orderly frames is one of the ways that it's talked about in the design world, where we have maybe low hedges that frame a meadow, you know, so we have that visual sort of organization that our mind wants that like feels drawn to it and it's beautiful that way versus just like, you know, everything's planted everywhere and I don't know what it is that I'm reading or how I'm supposed to interact with the space.
Mm.
Yeah.
I think in your book, it was so cool. I'm such a visual learner. So when a book, particularly a gardening book, has visuals on, okay, but how do I do it? Okay, right. But how does this actually work? Like I'm reading, yeah, I get it. I'll never forget Lisa Ziegler, her book on cut flowers. She has, you know, the illustrations of the beds and exactly how you plant it out. And I'd say a third of your book is like case studies on this is the before, this is the after, this is the, these are the instructions. And it was interesting that it's not like you're going in and doing the whole yard as one bed. You're isolating these beds. And then, yes, there can still be yards. And yes, the beds have, you know, can have borders. And it can be this kind of controlled chaos look instead of just chaos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I think we're more drawn to that just generally. You know, we like being in spaces that are beautiful, they're uplifting. And so I think it's an imperative of an ecological gardener or permaculturist or regenerative landscaper to make the space both beautiful and productive and healthy and, you know, and.
Mm-hmm. For people who are just wanting to get started, of the three principles in your book, what do you feel like is the most important one to start with?
Ooh, that's a really great question. They all work together, you know, but I think water is really the backbone of any design. You can't really have life without water. So that's a great place to start.
We've done more interviews on water in the last couple of years on this podcast as well, because I also feel like water, there's more water insecurity now than there used to be with global warming and climate change and, you know, drought tolerant gardens are like, those are some really good performing episodes of mine. And it's not just people listening to it in Arizona, you know, having to deal with water conservation. I think that's interesting. I feel like it's also maybe the least sexy of the three.
Totally. Pipes underground that you don't even see.
Yeah.
Totally.
Or like, yeah, but it's not a pretty flower. It's not like a pollinator. Right. This isn't going to attract a hummingbird. But I do think if you really want to commit to this principle of regenerative gardening, permaculture, starting with the water makes a lot of sense.
And that can be as simple as just, you know, taking one of your downspouts and burying a pipe and digging a rain garden. And then the rain garden is very beautiful. You know, you fill it with a compost sand mix and plant it with plants that can take high volumes of water because it'll drain pretty quickly after that. And those are a lot of native species that are flowering and are pollinator plants. And, you know, yeah, so it kind of marries the two, water and plants.
Do you do just in Atlanta or do you do all over the country?
We work primarily in Atlanta and regionally, like some, you know, North Florida, Alabama, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, depending on the size of the project. But then I have an online class as well that I work with students all over the country. So we have, I think at this point, a few thousand students that have gone through the course. And basically, it's the three pillars of a regenerative landscape. It's called the Regenerative Backyard Blueprint. And it takes students through how to map, how to do all of the groundwork, then how to think about their landscape from the perspective of water, soil, and plants and the built environment. And then it has a bunch of case studies and one-on-one coaching.
Oh, that's so cool. Coaching. Because I'm like, gosh, I wish I could just hire you to help me with this, but maybe I'll become your student. Maybe I'll take your class once I move. Once we've eradicated the termites and mold in this house that I just bought, I got to focus on the inside first, but maybe I'll become your student next year and take your class.
I love that.
So your book, which goes over these principles, and personally, my favorite part of your book is the end of it, the case studies, where you just see so many different layouts and ideas and application of these concepts. Where can we find your book? And where can we find you if we want to potentially take your course or learn more about your company?
Great. So the book is available on all major retailers, e-tailers. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it through our website. or through Goodreads. It's called The Complete Guide to Home Permaculture. And then our website is shadesofgreenpermaculture.com. And that's also our Facebook and Instagram handles.
Cool.
So you can find us there.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Brandy. And I can't wait to meet you in person in Seattle in a couple
of weeks. Yeah. Yeah. I'm excited. I can't wait.
For sure.
Thank you so much for having me today.
All right, plant friends, I hope this episode has you looking at your yard a little differently. Brandy really breaks it down like so good. And I really enjoyed her book because I am a visual learner and I love visuals. And I love visuals that teach me something. And she has so many different case studies in her book on actual landscapes, actual homes that she's transformed via permaculture. Oh, she's just such a treasure trove to learn from. Grab her book, check out her website. Everything's in the show notes. She's so great. And I hope you realize that even small changes can create big ecological ripple effects. And we can do it as gardeners. How freaking cool is that? So I hope you look at your yard a little differently after today's episode. And of course, that you keep growing joy.
Plant friend, thank you for tuning in today. It means so much to me that I get to be part of your planty journey. If you like what you heard, make sure you're subscribed to the show so you never miss an episode. We have so many incredible interviews and solo episodes on incredible houseplant and gardening topics that you will not want to miss this year. And while you're over there in the podcast player subscribing, why don't you click over to the review section of Growing Joy with Plants and leave us a review. Reviews are tremendously helpful for the growth of the podcast, so thanks in advance. If you're looking for more opportunities to grow as a plant parent with Growing Joy content, we've got so many options for you. First, I highly recommend you taking the Plant Parent Personality Test. It's free. It's super fun. It takes 3 minutes to complete. At the end of the test, you're going to get your plant parent personality profile and a curated list of plants, projects, and podcast episodes that are right up your alley, tailored just for you and your lifestyle, inspired by your results. The links are in the show notes. If you're looking to uplevel your plant parent game, I have so many free downloads on my website that I think could help you, like the Understanding Natural Light download or 9 different ways to green up your office space. If you'd like to support the show monetarily and help me bring the show to as many people as possible for free, you can head to our Patreon link in the show notes to learn more about our offerings. And finally, I invite you to come hang out with me and continue the planty conversation on social media, on Instagram and TikTok. I'm Growing Joy with Maria. My DMs are always open if you have requests for topics or ideas for the show. Thank you again for listening. It is truly my honor and delight to help you keep blooming and keep growing joy.